Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Echo Chamber podcast. A couple of quick things before we kick off. Obviously, I'm looking for your support. We want you to come on board. We want you to click the link that says patreon.com/tortoiseshack. But I want to let you know what you get for it. You will get access to our entire back catalogue, all of the Echo Chambers, Reboots, Policed, Muse Cult, all of the various podcasts that we've done through the years in one consolidated feed, entirely plea-free. You'll never miss an episode and you'll never have to listen to me do these annoying plugs. Not only that, but you get lots and lots of exclusives that never come out from behind the paywall, including in the last couple of days. Contributions from the likes of Daniel Mate, Quiva Butterly, and some brilliant music that was taken from the Rising event at Whelan's on Easter Sunday. And that's just one of over 1,600 podcasts that are all sitting there in our library at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. So while you're listening to this podcast, click the link, join us for a month, and I guarantee you you'll unearth several gems, conversations with people you probably didn't even know we spoke to. So one more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I'm shutting up now. Enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and folks, we spent a while looking at events, I should say, in water purity. We've talked to people like Niall Sargent. We've spoken to people across the environmental movement, and we've seen what the problems are. And we've also been worried, Martin, in our recent conversation with Fred Logue, about the changes to the planning and development bill that have implications for our lived environment and the problems that that can have. But one of the biggest stories in the country, on the island of Ireland, and I'll pull them up on this shortly anyway, has been the continued problems with Loch Ness. And the journalist who's done the best work on that anywhere is investigative journalist, freelance journalist, Tommy Green. And Tommy joins us again on the podcast to take us up to speed on what's happened since. Tommy, it's great to see you. How are you keeping?
Not too bad, Tony. Thanks for having me again on to speak.
No, we're absolutely delighted to have you back on, because you were someone who was talking about this. How do you, you know, before you're the pre-hipster, before it was cool.
Exactly. Yeah, right. That's it.
So if people, can we just do a quick summary to bring people up to speed if this is the first time they're hearing about it? Loch Ness is the largest lake on the island of Ireland, and it's one of the largest sources of fresh water. What were you writing about before it was cool to do it?
Exactly, before it was cool, yeah. So you're right. Loch Ness is the biggest, Ireland's biggest inland water body, and it is the largest water body and surface area on these islands. It supplies nearly half of the North's drinking water, in terms of there are a lot of things to say about it. And I guess prior to last summer, which was when it suddenly became an international news story, having for a long time not even being a really very prominent local news story.
It went green, Tommy, but just not for Patrick's Day.
Well, exactly. That's it. Yeah. It was the pollution at Loch Ness last summer, or the algal blooms. Which is really a kind of photosynthesizing algae. Those images were visible from the Copernicus satellite in space. You could see it from space. It was that widespread. So yeah, all of a sudden you had news crews from and TV crews from all over the world. Coming over to film what was happening and to speak to people after years of it being like a very peripheral issue, even here on the island, whether in the north or as a whole.
And it's privately owned, Tommy. It's a private, well, the bed and the lands are privately owned. The water itself is not privately owned.
That's correct.
But the Earl of Shaftesbury owns it.
Is he anything to the Duchess of Chamberlain or whatever the hell we're getting?
I'm quite sure we're all in the same bloodlines here. You know, they're all related to each other. But anyway, the current Earl feels he's getting blamed unnecessarily, and that he has no problem discussing any of this, but the discussion has to start with how much, because he won't discuss it in a greater good kind of way. No, it has a value. You want it, you pay. The previous value put on it was 6 million, and yet they never went through with the deal, and nobody really knows why they never went through with the deal. What would it cost now, Tommy, to buy it?
I don't know, but it certainly would be more than 6 million, I would imagine. So yeah, you're right. The Earl of Shaftesbury does own the bed and the banks and the soils of Loch Ness. The Shaftesbury estate doesn't own the water, but has made claims, let's say, to the water in decades gone by. They actually tried to charge water processing or authorities, I guess, public authorities, back for water abstraction back in the 70s. At the time, the Stirling administration opposed that. They seem to have dropped that claim. But the Shaftesbury estate, nevertheless, yes, still claims the bed and the banks. And yeah, the Earl of Shaftesbury, even before whatever figure he may or may not get for the sale of the loch, should that happen, has been making, has been receiving very generous royalty payments for industrial sand extraction at Loch Ness. So he gets a ton for every, a royalty fee. We don't actually know the what the sum is, but he gets a royalty fee for every ton of sand that is extracted from the bed of the loch, and something like 1.5 million tons have been extracted annually for decades now. So yeah, you do the math. He also gets royalty payments for hunting, shooting around the loch, and other activities, basically any kind of development. So, you know, when a council wants to, I don't know, you know, when a council wants to build a facility by the loch shore, when they want to develop the loch shore in some way, or even I imagine if they want to just improve access, which is a real issue at various parts of Loch Ness, they will have to, go through
just
the Shaftesbury estate.
Just for listeners' benefit, Tommy, where does the Lord live?
So he lives in Dorset. His ancestral seat or stately home, St. Giles House, is in Dorset. And he has, at least according to Vanity Fair, he has been using some of the profits generated at Loch Ness to renovate that stately home. He actually, I think, even described it in one of the interviews with Vanity Fair as the renovation project is almost grotesque, I think was the word he used, in terms of the overall cost of the project. So it gives you an indication, I suppose, of how much he may be earning already from the loch, never mind how much he may still earn if the executive buys it off.
And the whole, and Stormont is back up and running, as we know now, Tommy, but the whole of Northern Ireland, even though this water supply supplies half of the population of Northern Ireland, everybody's quite happy with it being in peerage hands and nobody seems to be doing anything about it. Why is that, Tommy?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people here are not happy about it, but certainly the decision makers seem to say that the ownership question is kind of a red herring. Even the new Agriculture and Environment Minister, Andrew Muir, actually said more or less that during the first Assembly debate of what's going to happen at Loch Ness in February, a week or two after the executive was reconvened, or after Stormont was reconvened, I should say, sorry. So, I mean, yeah, there's very much like a disconnect between kind of what public opinion is like on the ground and what decision makers are saying. I mean, yeah, it's a colonial hangover. It's a feudal kind of hangover. In the same way that like in Britain, you know, like the extent to which the aristocracy and the monarchy still own everything they do own is a feudal hangover. For many people, this it's not a red herring. It's a actually addressing the ownership situation is a precondition to actually remedying what's happening at Loch Ness. I don't know how you can develop a coordinated management strategy or anything else if you don't have full control over the water body in its entirety. You know, not just bits and pieces and fragments of it. So. Yeah, that's going to be it's going to be really interesting to see how that develops now over the next coming years. Now that this is finally a priority for decision makers here, so we will see what.
Tommy, people need to follow you, check out your work that you've done on this, and it's extensive. But I do understand why people politically want to back away from the ownership reason. Whether I agree with them or not, I understand why they would do that. But in terms of actually fixing, cleaning, bringing the lock up to standard, that's the main thing that people want to hear about. Has there been steps taken now that are going to actually secure it? Because funnily enough, I don't know if you saw this, the climate camp this year is hoping to be on the banks of Loch Ney. And the climate camp is a pretty bloody significant movement. As you know, these people go out, you know, to do no harm kind of thing, get together. It's a strange place to pick when we consider the potential environmental damage that's already been done in the area. What has been done?
That's a good point. Yeah. Basically, a lot has been said. In terms of what's actually been done, that's less clear. So yeah, there's been a lot of lip service that's been paid to Loch Ney in the first, you know, few weeks of the restored institutions here. It was mentioned in Michelle O'Neill's maiden speech. She's obviously from Washing Bay on the Loch's southern shores. There was a motion that was debated in Stormont, that was passed in Stormont, to set up a cross-departmental body that will kind of, look to begin to bring about a more coordinated sort of management approach. You know, that sounds great, but, you know, until the detail of that is made clear, I'm not really in a position to kind of make an assessment of it. But yeah, certainly the noises coming out of Stormont have been encouraging for some. I mean, another thing was a report with 113 recommendations on how to quote unquote save Loch Ney was promised by the end of February. We are pretty much into April now, and there's been no sign of it. So really, yeah, you're seeing kind of a lot being, as I say, a lot of lip service. But when you actually speak to fishermen or to other locals, or you speak to scientists, independent scientists, the sense
and is and you have spoken to the fishermen, and you know what impact it's having on them. You wrote a piece for Al Jazeera about it, and how their livelihoods were disappearing.
Yeah, exactly. This is the biggest. It's one of the most significant commercial fisheries in Europe, or in Western Europe. It's the biggest wild eel fishery in Europe as a whole. And yeah, many fishermen are facing, they're facing the loss of their livelihoods. A lot of them, you know, particularly eel fishermen, some of them only managed like 3 weeks last year. They can't go to a second consecutive, you know, year doing that. Like, it's just not going to be sustainable for them. So that is the next one of the next, I guess, issues that might kind of come into focus is, you know, the collapse of the fishing industry if the algal bloom becomes kind of a yearly occurrence, which it seems like this year that may well be the case. And I think like a really fundamental point is, despite all the kind of hand wringing that we've seen from politicians, public figures over the last year, despite the public outcry and the international news attention, no less pollution is going into Loch Ney right now. If anything, it's increased since last year, and it's very likely we will see another algal bloom this summer. There was a report that said it had something like 80% likelihood. So, you know, sewage infrastructure isn't being developed or upgraded, septic tanks aren't being addressed. I think Loch Ney catchment area has more than twice the UK average. I'm not sure about Ireland as a whole.
I'm gonna pull you up on that now. You keep saying UK, and it's getting. I saw you had a piece in the Guardian, and you referred to me as. So we're not happy with you, Tommy.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I'm happy to. That's grand. No, I mean, that's fair enough. Okay. But the last thing I'll just say very quickly is more factory farms are being approved than ever in the north too, which is so like the pressures on the water system or on the Loch system are nothing has changed there. As for the point on terminology. Yes.
Don't worry. Half that's aimed at you, Tommy. Half that's aimed at Sam, who's listening to this going, he says he's a friend of mine, but he always gives out whatever anybody says the UK. So that's for you, Sam.
I think, Tommy, that, you know, when you look at it, we're looking at Cork flooding, aren't we, really? That it's going to happen year in, year out. There's going to be an algae bloom, and we'll have a million different reports on what's the right thing to do. And 20 years down the road, everybody going, well, why didn't we solve this 20 years ago? Mm. You seem to be stuck in this position. And again, it's very hard to get away from, no matter what you do, unless you sort the ownership, all of it can be scuppered. And even when you're talking about the fishermen, you know, they've faced many a battle over the year where people did try and scupper what they were trying to do. So, you know, past performance is the best indicator, past behavior is the best indicator of future performance. And there doesn't seem to be any impetus on the Earl of Shaftesbury to make this work as a water supply for Northern Ireland.
No, I mean, there's not really any incentive for him to do it. Like, he's still getting his royalty payments no matter what happens. And I mean, I suppose you might say, or some might say, in his defense, I guess there hasn't been a serious offer. Like the last time this was on the table 10 years or so ago, civil servants drew up a report that basically found that, you know, they found there was no, I think their phrase was discernible value or benefit in bringing the lock into public ownership. So, I mean, I suppose in the absence of a convincing offer, I guess, from government here, and obviously part of the problem with that is that it keeps collapsing every couple of years. It's quite easy for him to say, well, you know, what proposal is being put in place? But yeah,
Even now, if they start today, how long is it going to take to put together the blueprint on this? What actual discernible ownership could do with it? What you could do if you had proper ownership? I mean, you're starting so far behind, Tommy. It is. I think Cork floods. I think it is. I just think it is. I think that's
so cynical, Martin. Everything's going to be rosy.
If you think about it and you step back from the picture, you have somebody who has inherited this body of water, who has done absolutely nothing to deserve it, who has got it through absolutely no work. You know, do the needs of the money not outweigh the needs of the one?
I would have offered him a pound and told him to fuck off. But that's just,
I would have just CPO'd it and said, listen,
£1 and off you go. Just to be a bollocks about it. But Tommy, it's a worrying trend. And you've written about stuff like this in the past. There is something strange happening whereby Northern Ireland particularly has been looked upon as what we can extract from it. You've talked about mining licenses. You've written about the idea of, you know, there's gold in them there hills. There definitely seems to be a concerted effort to get while the getting's good. And I know this sounds terrible because the political, movements for change that are happening there, they are happening in front of our eyes, but what was happening on the ground to the land that's owned, who owns it, who's going to be digging it, who's going to be drilling on it, that's, you've been writing about that. Am I right to be concerned about that?
Yeah, you are right to be concerned about it. I think, you know, both Lough Neagh and the extent of land here that's concessions to mining, international mining companies, is an indicator of, who's benefited most from the last, 25, 26 years. People were promised prosperity and peace in 1998, the time of the Good Friday Agreements. I mean, all of these things call into question what kind of prosperity and what kind of peace has existed here in the north during that time. So yeah, something like 25-26% of all land.
Can I cut in there and just pay you a huge credit for this? You pointed out that, say, Scotland had 7% of its land for mining concessions, but 2.5% for England. The north of Ireland has 25%. That cannot be an accident, Tommy. It was your journalism that uncovered that.
My calculations there. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so, an analysis. Yeah. So, yeah. But also, I mean, I would also add to that, that nearly 30% of land in the south of Ireland is, concession for mining too, for exploration work and other things. So it's something that the mining issue is something that, is something that affects the whole island. But certainly if you're looking at Lough Neagh and I suppose what some people would describe as the kind of carve up, in terms of opening up the north for international capital, including international mining companies, it does point to a model of neoliberal governance, paints a picture, I suppose, the last 25, 26 years. And it tells you, who has the system, I guess, been working for during this time. Yeah, it's been working fantastically for agribusiness. It's been working well for, like, international mining companies. It's working well for the Earl of Shaftesbury. But when you're looking at The things that government is supposed to be there to facilitate and supposed to affect, whether that's healthcare, education, protecting the environment, you know, it often seems to be.
Can I be blunt about this? There's a big argument at the moment going why the nature restoration laws are being pushed back in the European Parliament, and yet we see, as you said, those concessions. And I want to it's only 2008, we have to go back to the global financial crisis. So we saw what happened during that period when the mining companies themselves decided to take advantage of countries like that, were governments that were on their knees and say, yeah, you know, a few bob here, but we're going to drill, baby, drill in what you might have called a parkland or a natural woodland or a national park. And that's what's happened piecemeal. Yeah, I actually wasn't aware of Ireland, you know, the Republic of Ireland having 30% levels, but I'm not at all surprised by it. And I can see in Martin's eyes, he's not surprised either.
I knew they were opening it up, Tony. I just didn't realize that they had opened it up that much. Again, if you take Northern Ireland just as one of the provinces, they're not doing anything different in Northern Ireland to what they've done in Scotland, to what they've done in Wales. You know, they're extracting from the regions. They did it in Scotland with the oil, they did it in Wales with the coal, and they're doing it with ore in Northern Ireland. I'm just thinking again of the water for the people. So the solution for this summer, there are no solutions in place. Are we looking at tankers? Are we looking at standpipes, Tommy?
If there's a recurrence of the algal bloom,
when there's a recurrence of the algal bloom, to be honest,
exactly. I mean, it's not clear, and there was a big kind of, you know, even last year when the algal bloom occurred, then, you know, a lot of people, particularly in like around Lough Neagh, you know, a lot of people, like they were being told that their drinking water was safe, even though it had this very kind of like, you know, cloudy appearance and a kind of a very like a sort of metallic and odd sort of taste to it. You know, a lot of people just bought in bottled water, like because they didn't trust what they were being told by the authorities. So yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what measures are going to be put in place to ensure the continued supply of safe drinking water. If and or when, as you say, is more likely there is a recurrence of the algal bloom this year, this summer. I haven't seen anything concrete on that. People are obviously very worried about it. And and another kind of element of this is they don't trust what they're being told. And I think something that I've noticed more generally as these recovery efforts at Lough Neagh are beginning to be beginning to be underway or to become underway. Is that there is just very little trust, it seems, between, you know, people living in the area, communities, residents, grassroots organizations and public authorities, because for so long you know, the Lough has been so badly neglected, I guess. And
how are the farming community dealing with it, Tommy? Because they have the, like, one of the largest levels of runoff into the lake. They have, you know, I think, you again, back to your reporting, high levels of phosphorus runoff that would be the envy of every polluter in the world. That we've seen these kind of things. So, like, and I'm not here to dunk on farmers at all. I want to see them supported and given the opportunity to actually have sustainable food services, food provision in across the island. But how are they dealing with what is essentially one of the biggest challenges, that, you know, if that lock collapses, it'll take out the whole ecosystem, which will have a knock-in effect on their ability to actually, you know, do farming full stop.
Yeah, that's it. Like, you know, obviously farmers are at the front lines of climate change, but of course, yeah, the farming model here has been a significant driver of what's been happening at Lough Neagh. Yeah, something like 60%, according to the Department of Agriculture, Environment and Rural Affairs, according to their statistics, something like 60% of all phosphate inputs at Lough Neagh, in the Lough Neagh catchment area, which actually does cross the border and goes into Cavan and Monaghan. It is an all island.
We know about the chicken shit that crosses the border and gets dumped as well, by the way. That is true. Go back and listen, folks, to that story. It's incredible the amount of it that gets dumped, and it's both sides of the border.
Yeah, and a lot of it isn't accounted for. So I'd imagine that a good deal of it is being dumped in the Loch Ness catchment, along with other things, activities that seem to be going on in the catchment area, like illegal landfill and other kinds of things. So I mean, look, the farming sector has been under the microscope. Obviously, they're facing other quite significant changes, given that the North passed its first bit of climate legislation in 2022. So there's obviously been resistance from them, and you have to kind of put the kind of farming sector here within the kind of broader climate around farming at the moment, which is very volatile. We see that again. We've seen that in the south of Ireland too. You know, sort of questions of whether there's going to be a BBB style right wing populist farmers protest party sort of springing up, particularly if, for example, Fianna Fáil split at the upcoming election. So there will be resistance to a lot of this. But look, I mean, of course, like farming has got to be like with any sort of climate plan for any jurisdiction, like they've got to be a part of the solution. And there are plenty of farmers who want that. I guess the people who, more often than not, those who don't want it are, yeah, the big agribusiness corporations, you know, for whom this kind of intensification model is so profitable. I mean,
isn't it strange though that when we talk about farmers, and I've noticed this quite a lot, both south, north, when we talk about farmers, we actually couch it in very careful terms because we don't want to offend farmers. And yet, as you've said, it is a mix. There is the small farmer, but most of the farming business being done at the moment is big factory farming. That's what it is, big factory. But we're not allowed to speak to that because we might offend farmers if we speak about what this big business of farming is. And I'm getting to the end of my tether with it. I'm getting to the point where I'm going, hey, listen, you own the land. It's a business. You treat it like a business. Act like a business. You know, I don't think that we should be pussyfooting around farmers the way we're pussyfooting around them. Because for the most part, it's big factory farmers. And even if you're a small farmer, you're just a link in the chain to the big factory farmers.
That's not well. I agree with everything until the last few lines, Martin. There's a lot of small farmers who barely make it. We're scraping by.
There isn't a lot, no. Tony. There isn't a lot. And that's the truth. There's less farmers in this country than there are people living in Talla. Actual voting power is really small. So we give them a lot of leeway.
But look what happened in Brussels today. They shut down Brussels. Look what happened in the Netherlands. Look what's happening across the board. And you're right that there is this myth that is peddled. It's the you hate rural Ireland is what they then say, you know, and that's not the case at all. Or anything that will make farming have to become more ecologically minded and maybe rewarded for being, you know, looking at biodiversity. That'll be the death of rural Ireland. So we have all of these tropes that are thrown at all the time. So I agree what you're saying. But thankfully, and I say this with great sincerity, thankfully we have a uniter, someone who everybody wants to get behind and someone every consensus builder in Eamon Ryan who's going to make us all... Oh, sorry, I can't even finish a sentence. Oh my God, we're so fucked. We are so fucked.
But there is also there's a very valid argument in the Just Green Transition, which ties into all of this. There's a very valid argument in that when you're taking people's livelihoods away because you need to transition, you must then provide something else. You can't just leave them swinging and saying, "Hey, tough, you're
going back
news.
To going back to Luke Ming's point." Show me.
You can't do that. So within Loch Ness, there has to be an ABC of how you get from where Loch Ness is now, using the people that are already there, to where you want Loch Ness to be 5-10 years from now. Is there anybody working on that, Tommy? Anybody?
To be honest with you, I think this ties in quite nicely with what I was about to say, which is that I do really think that despite everything we've heard, I think the response has been just as fragmented as the kind of pre-existing management or administration of Loch Ness has been. Like, nobody really wants to address those harder economic conundrums or questions. Like, okay, you know, yeah, people have got to have a livelihood at the end of the day. And, you know, it's not, you can't just kind of Of course, the economic activity and the model that's in place now is damaging and putting so much pressure on the water system and on the watershed. But there has to be something for them to transition towards. So if you don't want to start addressing, like, you know, particularly the south, southern shores of Loch Ney and other parts of it, you know, got quite a strong industrial heritage. Why isn't somebody, why aren't we hearing about a kind of a Green New Deal for Loch Ney? Why are we not hearing about like how it could become a job creation opportunity, something that could stem, you know, this kind of depopulation of rural Ireland that could actually provide for the people who live there, but doesn't also mean that it's the loch itself is being harmed to the extent it is, or it's just becoming a site of extraction, whether that's for absentee landlords or whether it's for multinational companies. You got to remember, even with some of the agribusiness companies, like, you know, Moy Park is owned by JBS essentially, which is a Brazilian meat packer. I think it's the biggest meat production company.
Bring on Mercosur, baby. Bring on Mercosur. It's all good.
But, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you even go back to Cash for Ash and, you know, all of the money that, you know, a lot of the profits that are created through this kind of activity is not being, you know, it's not trickling down back into the north or anywhere else.
And
across
then
the
you
island.
Can understand why people become cynical, because they're like, oh, you want me to drive my cans now to a return scheme that doesn't work half the time, and when it does, it rejects all of this sort of stuff. And people are going, and you won't deal with what, you know, you won't deal with these multinationals. You mentioned Moy Park. That goes back to the chicken shit issue again, you know, the damage that's been done. Look, I just think, first of all, you've been doing amazing work. You really have. I think people need to keep get more clued in. But I would want one last question. Martin has said, where's it going? Okay, that's fair enough. But right now, you as someone who's looking at the actual, you said the climate bill passed in 2022. Is there a political will, do you see, to actually start implementing it? Because we've seen all of this sort of crap all the time where we say, whoa, Ireland passed the most ambitious climate action plan in the history of the world ever, and we've missed every target since.
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, yeah, and it's interesting again that you brought up kind of the Greens in government in the south and
Teals. We now call them the Teals. Teal, boys and girls, is described as a greenish blue, and that's what we have.
Come on. Well, exactly, yeah, and I suppose that kind of Eamon Ryan model of, like, you know, I suppose like sort of liberal modernization, kind of that kind of element of the green agenda. Yeah, like, it's who is that really delivering for? And, you know, even if you look at the number of kind of data centers and everything that have been approved in the south, I mean, well, you're thinking of, like, you know, the metals and everything else that are being mined, like, it's going towards those kinds of industries, or it's going towards, like, electric, you know, cars and all these kinds of other things. Is there the will? I mean, it's difficult to say. It's certainly a priority for this, you know, the decision makers here are not able to kind of ignore and kind of palm off Loch Ney in the way that they could in years gone by. Even, for example, 10 years ago when the civil servants wrote that report, and they were just, you know, the issue was just then shelved again for however many more years. And I suppose, like, the interesting dynamic is, you know, you are seeing more kind of grassroots organization around the loch itself. Those groups are getting stronger. But of course, also, you know, at the same time, they are running out of time, I suppose. Time is kind of against them. And if you are looking at the timescales of a recovery for Loch Ney that goes, you know, way beyond, you know, a 4 or 5 year term, that's assuming that, you know, this current executive makes, you know, it's, or, you know, runs the full distance, let's say, in terms of its current term. I would say, look, there is, you know, I'm not sure if it is even just a question of will. I just think, yeah, it's basically going to be a question of whether politicians kind of, whether they're under enough kind of pressure from civil society. It's probably also going to be a question of, you know, something I really kind of want to bring in here is, again, there is a role, I think, for a response here that goes beyond just the north. I think, as I said, you know, this isn't all Ireland's water body. And the government in Dublin has pledged something like 1 billion euro or something by 2030 investment for the north. I mean, it could play a really big role in the turnaround at Lough Neagh. One of the big mysteries of Lough Neagh is actually that Waterways Ireland, which is one of the kind of north-south bodies that was set up at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, has actually never had any jurisdiction over Lough Neagh. It's not really clear why that was, but clearly that's a very obvious way in which you could start to improve the governance is by, you know, bringing in those kinds of bodies and creating a more coordinated management strategy. I would say, you know, I really think there needs to be a sort of a sustained civic kind of
an all-Ireland response to an all-Ireland problem.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, even just when you look at, like, you know, who the management bodies are now, you know, there's a charity that's called the Lough Neagh Partnership, which seems to have kind of become the de facto management body at Lough Neagh, insofar as you can say that there is a management body at Lough Neagh. They've been getting quite a lot of funding for an exercise to explore different ownership models. A lot of this work was done like nearly 10 years ago by a group that Bernadette McCallisky was involved
who lives on the lough.
Who lives on the lough herself. Yeah. The partnership has representation from the Shaftesbury estate and from the biggest sand trading companies, which a lot of people see as kind of conflicts of interest. Their relationships it seems to have with a lot of local residents and campaigners is pretty fractious and seems to be deteriorating. I think as long as that continues to be the case, I really struggle to see how. I don't want to be too pessimistic at the outset, but I really struggle to see how they're going to, how they're going to address things. Look, the definition of madness is trying to do the same thing over and over again and hoping that you get a different result. Yeah. If you try and address Lough Neagh with the same kind of structures that have been done, or even the same exercises that have been done for years and years, and hoping that you're going to get the kind of overhaul that is needed, you know, that's a road to nowhere, you know. So
welcome to our hell, Tommy. This is the hell we live in. Yeah. This is the hell of ineffective politics who can't fix a problem. And it's not particular to the north. It's not particular to the south, nor to the Western Hemisphere. We now have politicians in place who can describe a problem, who can talk about it, but simply can't come up with the solutions to problems. And it's right across the world, and they're quite happy to live in this stasis, in this of never solving anything. Welcome to our hell. I do think civic society is the solution, and I think one long, hard, algae-prone summer where people have to stand at the back of trucks or standpipes or whatever it is, I think that's the civic impetus you need, particularly when it's going to affect tourism and something. And that's where it comes down to. It's not how much are your own people suffering, how difficult is it for a tourist to get a glass of water? And that's what solves these things at the end of the day. Tommy, thanks for all the work you do on it.
Not at all.
Frustrating to be here again this year. And we had so many people up nearly walking across the algae last year. We'll see, can we do more this year? Can we get more politicians to walk around the lake, say more nice words? And hopefully that'll work, Tommy.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, no, you're right. There is an element of Groundhog Day. And look, there's certainly a view that, they're hoping that this will all just kind of blow over and that another crisis will kind of supplant the Lough Neagh crisis. So, I don't want to be too kind of cynical or pessimistic, like at the outset, but the longer that it goes on without anything substantively changing, I suppose the more credence, that viewpoint kind of, gains, I suppose. So, yeah, we'll
continue to cover it, and thank you so much. And I will say that, Martin, there is an alternative to this now. There is an alternative. You can decide that potable water or drinking water is woke, and therefore you don't have to do anything about it. You can just say anybody who wants water is woke, so we don't need to, you know, only, you know, if you want to be a
Earl of Shaftesbury, do not, my friends, become addicted to water.
We'll leave it there with his evil laugh, the evil laugh of the Dark Lord. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the end. subscribe now on Patreon.